It's those two assholes, those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That's, you've hit the third rail for sure.
That is the third rail, saying white people have interest.
Third rail. The third rail here is another wonderful show on our TRS network.
And it's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. That's high voltage.
And the opinion of this reporter, if this nation, or in fact the world, ever needed heroes, that time is now. That time is now.
Like all the REN stores in America holding their breath for a $2,000 stimulus, this is happening. Episode 182 of the most huggable and most huggable podcast. I'm sorry, most handsomest podcast ever recorded. We're off to a killer start. Howdy, I'm your host and resident mouth of the South, Bellerophon. Joining me today, we have on the mics the man who has dedicated his life to teaching Baudrillard to juggalos, Borzoi. Say hey, sir.
I did enjoy the little Michigan deep cut reference there.
I thought you might. You know, one of these days we'll get you on hyperpodcastism, just going over the, you know, all of the Shakespearean elements, like, you know, of the ICP versus Eminem.
I'm sure I can get Shaggy Too Dope, and I think what's the other guy, Killer J or something. I'm sure I can get
Violent
both of them onto hyperpodcastism. Violent J. Thank you, Violent J. Clout has been retracted. I don't know the names of the Insane Clown Posse, but I'm sure those guys aren't really doing much and everything. We could talk about scientists and the like, and we'll get to the heart of really what the Dark Carnival is all about.
there is allegedly some like super, you know, half-ass like stoner mythology behind it. But
I'm familiar with it. When I heard that they had this mythology once, I spent the better night like on various wikis or something trying to figure out what is the Dark Carnival. And actually, spoiler, it's y'all need Jesus. That's what the Dark Carnival ultimately means. No, and I'm not, that's not even a joke. The whole mythology ends with basically imploring the juggalos to accept Jesus into their hearts.
Based. I did not see that coming. But I can imagine, too, as you were looking up all that stuff, your JNCOs grew three sizes that day. All right. But before we get too far into the juggalo posting...
Hyper-juggaloism.
We might already have a show title like 5 minutes
in. Yeah, writing that one down.
And also, we've got the man who bills himself as the future Führer of the Indian subcontinent, Dharma King. Say howdy.
India great superpower 2021.
Indeed. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say we might also get Nikkei, but he's running on Greek time right now. So
Greek people time, Indian people time, same.
I am not allowed. But what I was going to say for him, and this is too good of a joke for me to waste. But what I was going to bill him as is, according to classical mythology, the man whose podcasting voice launched 1,000 Khazar milkers, Nike. A little much. I don't know. I was feeling.
I thought Borzo was the one who kept drawing the Khazar milkers with his silky smooth voice and takes.
Oh, that's now that is the meme deep lore.
Thankfully, it's not even that deep. I mean, if the meme was going on until I got married this year,
right?
So.
Yeah.
Oh man. No, the deep lore is that if you want a real Borzoi deep cut deep lore meme, it's that I sound like David Cross. That was the original meme.
Oh shit! Do you want blood?
I don't know David Cross's voice well enough, except for I'm trying to think of him on Arrested Development. You don't sound that familiar to him.
I don't know. I think it's a cadence thing or something. I don't know. I don't get
Could
it.
Be.
If I listen hard enough as the blood is pouring out my ears, I can almost sort of hear it. But...
Did you see he had a really, while we're maybe shitposting before that, he had a really vile tweet the other day. It was basically, I think it was like just a generic call from, I think it was Joe Biden's Twitter account for whatever unity and healing and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And David Cross, you know, master comedian, said very hilariously, fuck that, I want blood.
Yep.
Great joke, David.
Yeah, nice, after a year of pain and loss, it's time to unite, heal, and rebuild. And Cross replied, fuck that, I want blood, which, of course, stirred up our people. And on the 20th, he said, this tweet has really taken off. I feel that I should be clearer, though. While I do want blood, I only need about 14 cc's of it, and not from everyone, just Kyle McCarthy in Davenport, Iowa. I will explain later.
What is it with Jews? Ooh, and 14. They just want, like, what does he need that? I mean, what does he need that blood for? What are you doing with that blood, Rabbi?
Presumably
it's for the sacrifice or whatever kind of occult Kabbalistic ritual they're going to do to summon, like, demon cyborg RBG.
God, please forbid that. Do not give them any ideas.
I am loving the responses to this that are all come and try pussy soy lib Hollywood girl woman, as if these anonymous MAGA chuds and chudettes don't practice the same exact feckless violent fantasy trolling.
Chudettes. Oh, that's good.
First of all, David, like, every single one of our guys, those are not our guys per se, because especially the ones saying that are not our guys, because our guys, we said that we're going to federal prison. So, like, what are you talking? I mean, just completely clueless and out of touch. Also, I just really want to say, I love the Jewish humor here. This is the fabled Jewish humor, right? This is like a funny, self-deprecating, very clever, kind of high verbal IQ, you know, funny, right? I'm laughing.
Well, here's an actual funny joke. Minesweeper, he just realized, well, I guess he agrees that I sound like David Cross, because Borze, when he posts graph again, I just blue-lined myself.
All right. But hey, before we get too deep into that, just to round out really quickly, and then we can go back to piling on David Cross's sorry ass. did want to just introduce us real quick behind the knobs. The Grand Wizard of Audio, who allegedly never takes off his Burger King crown. We've got TV's Frank. Say hey, Frank.
I think he missed his cue. He had a good one, too, this time.
Ah, man. Oh, well. Suspense is killing me. Man, we're all just working off those Christmas carbs. We ate too good over the holiday, and we're just trying to get back in the rhythm, I think. but, yeah, and then before we get into our table of contents really quick, or we can just spend 2 hours, like, shitting on David Cross. Either one's fine with me. We do have a quick word from our sponsor. Are you a black-pilled bro? Are you worried that you'll be too positive in 2021? Fear not. The buxom goth broads at 1-900-BLACKPILL are ready to talk to you today and throw cold water on all your hopes and dreams. Data and messaging rates do apply.
I feel called out.
I mean, if you heard it, it's for you. So I don't know what to tell you, man. if you need to get off the call and, you know, give them a call really quick, I understand.
Well, guys want to get into the table of contents here?
Sure. Oh, let's do it to it. Yeah, what you got for us, Boris?
All right. Well, apparently, I did the bulk of the prep today. So I got for my I need to scroll. Winner, I got A. Wyatt Man. Loser is COVID vaccinations. And topic, why I won't let my kids watch Christmas specials. It's a Tablet Mag article.
Oh, that last one does sound juicy, especially coming from Tablet Mag.
I know Christmas is over, but we are trad here on the show, and we are going to celebrate 12 days of Christmas. So technically, it is still Christmas. So I feel completely within my rights to talk about Christmas still.
Hey, no pushback here, man.
Plus, you have to remember, the Jews are trying to pump up Hanukkah, their 8 crazy nights, try and make it seem like it's a bigger deal than Christmas, although, like, that's always fallen flat because who gives a shit? And they're trying to relegate us to one day for Christmas. Like, no, if Jews are taking 8 days, we're going back to the full 12 days. That's how it's going to be from now on.
Indeed. I've done the 12 days since, maybe it's because I, you know, yeah, but I've just always, to me, January 6th has been the official end of Christmas, period.
Yep.
Like, so yeah, I'm all for that.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Christmas is until the Epiphany. Right on, chat.
Yeah. And basically, I want, I will not rest until there's as many days celebrating Christmas as there are seemingly monthly Holocaust Remembrance Days. So you know, until we hit that mark, you know, fuck it, dude. 100 days of Christmas, 300 days of Christmas.
Well, if you think about, I mean, I don't know about 100, but if you think about it, like, basically Black Friday to January 6th is, you know, that's a good chunk of the year, frankly.
The Christmas beatings until holiday cheer improves.
We should just stage, like, you know, because Shakespeare wrote a play, Twelfth Night, about, yeah, the Twelfth Night. So we should, like, you know, staging Shakespeare's Twelfth Night to own the Hebes.
Yeah, Twelfth Night.
Well, you know, but Shakespeare was black, though. Don't forget.
Oh, shit. I forgot. Yeah. Oh, man.
But yeah, what do you got for us?
That was my table contents. But do you guys have anything?
Yes. My winner is Mitch McConnell. My loser is No Coiners. And I don't really have a topic except for maybe we could, I don't know. I'd be curious to, I think it would be good to talk about, you know, what to expect in 2021. And just kind of looking forward. So, yeah.
I think that's good.
Works for me. And then my winner is Academic Studies on Gamer Words. And my loser, Based Plane Rides. So, what do you think?
I know what I want to do first, but I'm going to call this out right here. Right? Minesweeper's been on the been very much on the QAnon stuff lately. He points out that January 6th is also the end of Christmas for QAnon too. That's going to be the moment we know.
Oh no, you're not aware of the super woke take. There's the cope that I've seen is now this may actually it's kind of almost maybe without a difference, but the cope that I've seen is after everything fails on the 6th, then the mother of all bombs lawsuit drops on the 7th.
Yeah, I'm sure there's always something more, but it just amused me to see that because Sweeper and I had been talking about. So if anyone knows about studying gospel studies, basically in terms of studying the history, how the four gospels came into being. People might know that there is something called the Q document or the Q gospel.
Oh yeah, the Q for Quella, which means source. Is like the exactly.
Because you can tell that both Matthew and Luke, at least like under if you follow this study, Matthew and Luke can obviously borrow from the Gospel of Mark. Now there are alternative opinions on the stuff. I'm just going off the general orthodoxy of this field of study. Matthew and Luke draw off of Mark, but there are differences between Matthew and Luke that indicate there would have to be another source, and that's called the Q Gospel or the Q document. And Sweeper and I have kind of wondered. I wonder if the QAnon people have ever discovered that or have ever talked about that. And sure enough, they have, and it's led into. Ultimately, I think it's good because we've been stringing out kind of what Sweeper's view on the Q stuff is. He's been learning about this guy called Thomas Schoenberger, who's some say is the mastermind behind QAnon. I'm not going to get into any of those specific stuff, but
I do want to say really quick one thing about Schoenberger, because mine sent me the article as well, and it was really interesting. I don't know either way. I know Microchip, the famous, you know, Microchip has also claimed responsibility for Q. I think there's a lot of things and actors, including some federal agencies, alphabet soup types behind Q. The Schoenberger connection was very interesting because, apparently Schoenberger was involved in some kind of alternate reality game. I forget the name of Cicada 3031 or something like that.
Oh yeah. That that thing that was supposedly meant to draw upon people who were involved in some kind of, depending on who you ask, some kind of intelligence operation or a hacker project or a internet security type thing. And they had created these whole various complex puzzles and games that were
with like stuff embedded in JPEG images and references, and you had to know like a Welsh manuscript or something. And it's exactly the kind of you know, alternate reality game with these so-called breadcrumbs where one clue leads you to another clue, like you're in a, you know, Hollywood thriller movie or something that
it's like National Treasure for Boomer.
Exactly. And but you know, with like internet. And so I seems like there's definitely something there. If I don't know. I have no way of assessing Schoenberger's. I think the story on Q, if and when it does get written, will be fascinating. I'm sure he'll be a part of it. But the thing that really caught my eye was, yeah, there's this aspect to the QAnon thing that it's basically like an alternate reality game. Some of you might remember, Halo 2, the I Love Bees was really popular for a while. There's stuff like that. There's this alternate reality game aspect to Q that definitely goes with Schoenberger's involvement in that cicada thing. So that's all I wanted to highlight.
Sweet. Well, Sweeper sent me an interesting message this morning that I think encapsulates a lot of his views on this, and I think it's worth putting out there. So he's just learning about Schoenberger. Some claim he's the person who started Q as a prank, super prolific prankster, grifter, scam artist, very shadowy background, cult-like following. I was reading about him, and I kept thinking Manson. I don't think he started Q, but it's becoming clear to me that Q is some sort of rat king of fed op, online pranksterism, and occult and cultic activity. Adding boomer schizophrenia and fanaticism, and you have an explosive compound like we haven't seen. And I think that summarizes my view on all that stuff as well. And I actually kind of spoiled my prep a little bit because I'm going to talk about this a little bit in the context of the COVID vaccinations. That's the debacle that's been going on. But it's just, we're living in strange times, guys.
Oh, yes, we are. Oh, that's, yes, we, this is why I keep harping on normalcy bias. Like, things don't change until they do. And, you know, like, the part of what it means to be in the kind of geo-historical situation we're in, you know, some people call it the Kali Yuga. I'm partial to that, but you don't have to believe in the Kali Yuga or the Yuga system at all to sort of recognize that the stability that we have enjoyed from especially the collapse of the Soviet Union, if not the end of the Second World War, is rapidly coming to an end. That whole new world order that they set up is changing in some important ways. And you know, I think the jury's still out on how that's going to end up shaping up. But as far as where we are now, you cannot use the past as a guide to the present, even on a yearly basis, even on a monthly basis, the way that you used to be able to. And it's very important to understand that.
Which is why I understand people getting very lonely in this day and age. It's very easy to become completely isolated and completely atomized.
Absolutely. And well, one of the big kind of big picture, and this isn't a thing that, you know, well, I guess it is. I was going to say it wasn't something that changed just in a year, but it is actually because of COVID. People working remotely, people living apart from families. Seems like one of my oldest friends is going to be moving away for essentially a job opportunity. And that's, not uncommon. And I mean, it's increasingly common. And I think it's an inherently unstable civilizational arrangement. I would go so far as to say it's not compatible ultimately with civilization. I think moving, you know, once this kind of, these crazy years sort of come to an end, that people will either come to some kind of understanding, or there will be a legal, cause there, you know, in the past you've had legal situations where you were essentially not legally allowed to leave either, you know, your village or the region that you were from, depending on, you know, the country or whatever the polity you're talking about. I think something like that is very much going to be in the works, some combination of official or legal and just sort of cultural, because this can't continue. This system of, you know, you move from your support network and your extended family and all your friends to go get a job in a major metropolitan area, and then get packed into a tin sardine twice a year to see your actual family at Christmas, and then you sort of make up for this your actual family with this TV fed notion of like, oh, you know, we live a family of choice and y'all are my family, you know, essentially your coworkers and whatever assortment of random degenerates shows up to your house on a given Saturday night. That's just not that's not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. And
if I may as well, you know, talking about the that sort of arrangement, right? Your chosen family, that sort of thing. If there has been one silver lining, I guess, to COVID, it's that it seemed to have completely killed the really fake and gay Friendsgiving meme, which I absolutely detested.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's as well on all this, McNabb's been he wrote an article about the age of anti-politics. And one thing he and I were talking about is that talking about politics is very silly in this day and age for one reason being it's almost like, you know, being under the Soviet regime and talking about, you know, Soviet elections in terms of the party list is like, what are we really even talking about here? Yep. Does it even really matter? But the other aspect of it, and just this connects with the QAnon alternate reality game stuff. I mean, it's not really so much an alternate reality game anymore as an alternate reality.
Or it's just the reality, and I mean, I don't know. Well, yeah, but go on.
But, I get what I mean by this is because I spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks with my family and with my in-laws, and thankfully we're mostly on the same page. There are differences, but we're mostly like, at least we're grounded in, for the most part, similar realities. But I was thinking about this in terms of trying to, whenever COVID stuff especially comes up, what ends up happening is that people often talk, even people who agree on everything else, people end up talking past each other because the reality that the individual reality each person's now kind of being boiled in requires levels of explanation of what do I actually mean and what am I actually talking about, where you have to actually introduce another person, even somebody you're related to this entire other reality system that you've been imbibing in for a long time. That I've seen it happen a lot of times where people are just literally just talking right past each other because the way that they are experiencing the world is so wildly different, even though they fundamentally agree on what they're talking about. And it's becoming this situation where it's just completely intolerable. Imagine having to constantly explain to another person you're speaking to what you're experiencing on a day-to-day basis so they understand where you're coming from. It's an intolerable situation.
No, it's completely, it's intolerable, it's unsustainable, it's fake and gay, and I don't want to, one of my kind of failings is I see the pattern, I see the trend, and I extrapolate that because I see it this way that either more people than actually can see it that way, or that it's all going to kind of come to a head more quickly than it ends up coming. So I don't want to, like, you know, make any predictions, not because of clout, just because I don't want to give people the wrong idea. But I do want to say that, you know, and obviously I'm not unique in this, you know, Borzoi, if anything, you're the, you know, Mr. Collapse. But yeah, this is just obviously not going to end well. And it is going to end sooner rather than later because it just can't go on. It really literally cannot.
Yeah. But the only thing I think people are going to be shocked by is, I mean, will it come to an end? Yes, but I think people might be shocked by how long it can go on.
And yeah, sure.
Because they're in constant hyper calibration in terms of trying to make this work.
The problem that I see, and maybe this is sort of whatever, it doesn't matter. The problem that I see with that, because you're definitely right, and I think your article on, you know, this Christmas special, like, we can't even have Christmas specials anymore, and. You know, we literally can't have anything anymore, and people. But, like, okay, how? I feel like that in its own way is catabolic. They have to put so much energy and exponentially increasing amounts of energy into managing every single person's expectations and sort of narrative reality. Just QAnon to circle back is another great example of this. It's pretty clear to me. I think this is, you know, we could say whatever else it is or has become in its origins, there's definitely this kind of psychological operation component of just keeping people, you know, there was an energy to 2016. There was a definite possibility from their perspective for the Trump presidency to go off the rails into something, you know, kind of like 1920s Germany that they really, really, really wanted to avoid. What's the best way to avoid that? Is rather than keeping people energized, rather than allowing people to continue to get in the streets and you know, express control over physical space, to keep them on this hamster wheel, to keep them like, oh, just the plan, everything's being taken care of behind the scenes. Okay, so you create this little, you know, retard box for them. And
I don't think it's coincidental that this coincides with the rise of escape rooms and things like Hunt a yeah. Killer in the rise of as entertainment.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. People's pattern recognition software in their brains is like, you know, everything you're being thwarted from noticing crime stats and you know, immigration patterns and things like that. And so, yeah, but make sure, you know, you can still flex those cognitive muscles in an escape room, in QAnon, in whatever like that. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'm sorry, I keep cutting people off.
No, please.
My apologies. I think I'm on like a quarter second delay or something for some reason. But yeah, to kind of synthesize, right? Like talking about atomization, talking about like the holiday season, being lonely, you know, and QAnon, like, what kind of strikes me, I guess, is, with all this trust the plan stuff is it in many cases, I sort of witnessed in real time, people were substituting Q announcements, Q prognostications or Q theories, sort of like a substitutionary advent calendar. You know, they're looking at certain dates, you know, and you know, I guess offering up their Fed posty tweets in lieu of prayers, you know, and just how it's in some cases, at least anecdotally, it did kind of take the place of like a normal advent schedule.
Yeah. And it's definitely become a kind of substitute religion for people. And because that's I guess where I was going with this is there's so much energy. There's so like okay, they tried to redirect it into this retard box, but you know, as Mindsweeper saying in the chat, the problem arises when the hamster jumps the wheel. Not to say the hamster is competent to strike off on his own, but he's off the wheel now. That's the thing is like, okay, we put people in this box, but they broke out of it to some extent or it became just something completely different. And all of that energy is still there. And now they're even closer to, cause I, you know, I was following the Q thing from fairly early on. And there was always this thing about like patriots are going to save the day and don't worry, trust the plan. And you can trust Christopher Wray. I mean, people forget, but like trust Wray was a constant message in the early days. That's all gone now. Wray is going to be, you know, whatever, executed on Gitmo if he hasn't already been. But it's completely changed. And now instead of this kind of shadowy thing about Democrats and traitors, it's like, no, there's a satanic pedo cabal. And they really, really don't like that. And they really, cause it's like, I mean, that's substantively true. A lot of what they're saying is substantively true and it's increasingly substantively true. And they're increasingly naming the right names, which is not a situation that they want to be in. So in order to manage that narrative, in order to manage all those expectations, they have to put even more energy to, I don't even know. I don't think you can just create another retard box like that. You have to, I mean, some of it, like, you know, Jazz Hands and other people have identified, they keep them going, oh, look at Tom Hanks. Look at, you know, anyone other than Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein and all these Jews, you know, make sure you focus on just random, seemingly nice goys. Okay. That's only going to work on some of them for only so long. That's definitely not going to work. Should buy, you know, like into a Biden administration, into a Harris administration, that's like that kind of strategy is not going to work. Sooner or later, they're going to discover the name Willie Brown. Sooner or later, they're going to start looking into Doug Imhoff. And really, then all bets are off.
That reminded me, did you guys see what was going on with Lynn Wood?
No, I did not.
Yes, I have.
Has he gone off the reservation?
What's happened? In a very big way. Well, okay. So as with everything, it's kind of impossible to like, first of all, I just want to know, it's not even like in a Reddit way. I want to know what his sources are. I want to know because I guess the TLDR on Lynn Wood is he has in the past, I don't know, 24, 48-ish hours, not only said definitively like Jeffrey Epstein is alive. It's the John Roberts who's on the flight logs is the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. And like Mike Pence may or may not be executed for treason in Gitmo.
By firing squad.
By firing squad. Right. Because that's why they have that cope about that's why, you know, Donald Trump brought firing squads back for the executions that are about to happen. I will, you know, cards on the table, and this is, I think, Hank Oslo's take, not mine, but the Federalist types, like Sean Davis was agreeing with, it doesn't matter. Sean Davis was, you know, shitting on Lynn Wood, saying that, you know, he's just a complete lunatic, and he very well may be, but the fact that federalist, you know, kind of edgy conservative kosher types are counter signaling him specifically for the Roberts stuff makes me more rather than less likely to think that that particular aspect is true, that the name, that the John Roberts, because there's a John Roberts on the flight logs. That's an, the question is, who is it? And the sort of, as far as I'm aware, the only real controversy is it John Roberts, the Fox News correspondent, or is it John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States? And that reaction makes me do a big think as far as like, yeah, that seems more than less likely that it's the Chief Justice. As far as the Mike Pence stuff, that needs to be interpreted as basically they are increasingly aware that Mike Pence isn't going to do shit on January 6th. And so they need to have some kind of mental framework for why that is the case.
Yeah. I was trying to pull up some of the tweets, but he's tweeted so much on this stuff. But yeah, and also Jeffrey, did you mention one of the things like him saying Jeffrey Epstein's being still alive as well?
Yeah, he said Jeffrey Epstein's still alive. That's why he was like, oh, that was the thing. He was like, why don't we go ask John Roberts why he was on Epstein's Island? In fact, why don't you ask Epstein himself? He's alive. Yeah. Like, okay. Which, I mean, look, I don't want to rule that out either.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know the paranormies take on it, and I'm not going to say it's wrong. I am going based off of the fact that Linwood is the attorney for Kyle Rittenhouse and is involved in a lot of these Republican Party politics. And I'm just trying, and he's probably the most, he's got the Where We Go One, We Go All. So yeah, he's full QAnon stuff.
Oh, he's
so
full, he's Q. Probably the most, he's number two after, or maybe number three after Sidney Powell and Mike Flynn. He's like the high, he's one of the high priests of Q for sure.
And I just point to Linwood as how entrenched this is, and the way that because we're used to, when it comes to stuff that's being labeled as crazy, we're used to just operating in those fringes. But this is how mainstream this has become for a significant portion of the electorate.
Absolutely. And it's not just, I mean, I would say at this point, it's probably a majority of Republican voters, especially white voters. I really think you need, like, and this is why it's important to pay attention to Q. You could say like, oh my God, Q is retarded. Why are you talking about it? First of all, I think
because Q is retarded, that's why I'm talking about it.
Exactly. Well, it's, number one, it's great. I mean, it's just endlessly fascinating, but also you have to look at it as like, okay, it's a movement. I mean, it's a large and growing movement. It is the future of the Republican Party. It is the present of the Republican Party. That's what I guess the thing you have to understand. Like over the weekend, so you know, of course, the $2,000 checks were dead because of Mitch McConnell, my winner of the week, who, you know, as a flex, just was like, nah, we're not doing that. You're not getting any more money. Bye. So okay, and Mitch McConnell, for now, you know, he won this. He got what he wanted. You know, he served his masters very well. Good for you, Mitch McConnell. The thing is, the revolt among the grassroots of the Republican Party. Like, I saw tweets from the Columbia Bugle. I saw tweets from Ann Coulter. I saw and not even just those. I guess those are kind of, you know, more in the towards the right wing of the Republican. But like the $2,000 was popular with absolutely everybody. There's nobody who buys this thing about I think it was John Cornyn, you know, senator from Texas, another tweet. He was eating tenderloin at a steakhouse in Texas, and he just got obliterated in the replies by like normal Texas GOP types. People have had it, and so when someone like Lynn Wood goes up there and says, you know, Mike Pence is going to be arrested for treason because he's part of the Mitch McConnell, like they're naming Mitch McConnell as part of the cabal. That's, you know, like, what do you do with that? Well, you have to understand it as these people are at their limit. They're no longer listening. They're not listening to they're no longer listening to the right side of the kosher sandwich. I guess that's the key point here, is that it's not just that they don't believe in whatever the kind of mainstream narrative is. They don't believe in the right side of the kosher sandwich at all. They're no longer going to be contained. So what happens next? I don't know, but, you know, I hope you have, like, just, you know, make sure you have camping supplies. I don't know. Like shit could get very, very crazy. I want to say, you know, I don't want to like, yeah, just be prepared.
I don't know what to expect, but the relevancy in talking about this, about trying to untangle what the Q beliefs are, they're fun to kind of mention, but the reason why it's worth us bringing it up is because we constantly have these internal dialogues and discussions in our scene over, I'm trying not to be condescending, but let's call it the red pilling the normies. And people agonize over this. They strategize over this. They try to figure out how do you talk to people about this stuff. And if people have interacted with me, then they know I'm generally disdainful of the concept of that I call it big normie. Like that there's this certain idea of a normie that people have that is like, okay, now if I just know the exact code of how to speak to them, I can get them to listen. It's an individual, like you have to meet people where they are type thing, but there's no, I just don't believe in this simple idea of a normie, really. And the efficacy of trying to red pill them, as it were. I mean, I point to the Q stuff as this is what you're dealing with. There is a substantial amount of the population that believes this kind of stuff, and they went down a bizarre rabbit hole to get where they are, or are they simply just because they trust the people who are saying things they like to hear? And I don't think that's something you can untangle. But what I like to point to this as is, I think people need to think in terms of factions or tribes, and we have our own faction, our own tribe, and there are people, you know, there's some cross-pollination with, but you're never, like a lot of them, some of them you can bring over, a lot of them you're not going to be able to, but the best way to utilize them and to interact with them is how do you point them at shared enemies? And I think that's what people need to think of this in, because some people in the chat were saying we shouldn't be reaching out to Q people, and I agree with that in the literal sense of like I'm never going to try and direct my content in a way to try and trick Q people into being white nationalists or whatever.
Gotta red pill the Q-tards, bro.
Yeah, like, but you know, sometimes, but you can also like slip in little red seeds from time to time or things that will point them in certain directions. I have zero expectation of these things becoming what I ultimately would want them to be, but when it creates problems for shared enemies, I think that's the healthiest way to look at this stuff, but this is what a fractured country that is prone to cultic activity looks like, and I think that's how people need to assess their expectations of the decade to come.
100%.
Oh yeah, and along those lines. Oh, go ahead, man.
No, please you.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry again for the delay. I think it's getting a little better, but. But yeah, you know, along those lines, right? Like when, you know, our favorite tribe of people, when they try to, you know, weaponize folks who are in their out group, you know, against honkies, against white people, you know, they're not dropping quote unquote red pills. They're not getting them fully convinced on Zionism. They're not getting them fully convinced on like, you know, a one state solution. They're not getting them 100% in agreement with all of their beliefs, right? They just, like Borzoi said, they point them towards a common enemy, get them stoked up, and, you know, send them off to the races. They're not concerned about like fully evangelizing and getting somebody 100% on board with everything that they internally believe. You know, it's not it's not necessary to get somebody 100% on board, like you were alluding to earlier. That was my only contribution.
That's why when it comes to, I mean, I think our people know this very well, even if they know this intrinsically, but that's why when trying to understand Antifa, you don't read Kropotkin or Marxist dialectics to understand Antifa. You watch Netflix to understand Antifa. That's where they get their understanding of the world from. It doesn't matter how many different hammer and sickle patches they, you know, apply or how much they signal that, like, you know, black bloc tactics and all that. Spiritually and fundamentally, they are not cribbing from actual theory. They are cribbing from what motivates them on a fundamental level. And that's why I think thinking things in terms of tribe and faction will help you understand the world we live in a little bit better, especially because we're moving towards a micro tribal kind of, well, at least in this country, we're moving very much towards micro tribes. And it's the only way we're going to, I think, going to have be able to have an anchor to understanding this alternate reality situation.
No, No, that makes total sense, man. I'd never thought about it makes sense once you said it out loud, right? But I never thought about it that some 40-year-old washed up, you know, drug-addled Antifa, right? Like that 40-year-old Antifa is less Das Kapital and more, I don't know, Sex and the City and Will and Grace. That those are more meaningful ways to you know, understand them if you even care to.
We haven't actually even gotten to any of our prep, by the way.
That's fine. I think this was good stuff. Hey, we got to my winner, Mitch McConnell, so that's something.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of interested in gamer words.
Sounds great.
Oh, dude, let's do it to it. Yeah, so admittedly, this is just a quick, like, maybe 5-10 minutes just for a palate cleanser and what have you. So I was looking for, I guess my loser of the week was, based plane rides. It looks like there's a successor to the gentleman who is wearing a Burger King cap and, kept
getting
kicked off
plane. There
can only
ever be one king. He is the king, but I suppose you have a prince or something.
Well, every king needs a queen.
The Burger Prince, yeah, the Burger Queen.
Yeah, so every king needs a queen. And, so anyway, there's a woman on Frontier Airlines, and we'll get to this, I guess, here in a bit, right? And she was, I was trying to find the story, figure out what was going on there. Oh,
that's actually, that's a title right there. Every Burger King needs a Burger Queen.
Oh, man. Yeah, we might, I might be hitting some miscues and misspeaking, but at least the creative juices are flowing. So as I was just Googling, right, like trying to figure out what was going on with that story, I did stumble across just an absolutely delightful JSTOR article from it was the Winter Publication.
Speaking of JSTOR, sorry to interrupt, but I'm not going to have any other opportunity to talk about this. Did you guys happen to see on Twitter when I was doing some Ottoman Empire research? And an article I found.
Oh, no, you didn't. Lay it on me, man.
I have to scroll through because I took a screenshot. I have to scroll all the way back towards right before Christmas to get there. But I mean, I'm still learning a lot about the Ottoman Empire, but there is so. Yeah, here it is right here. I agonized over whether or not to buy this article because I couldn't get access to it. Displaying manhood and masculinity at the Imperial Circumcision Festivity of 1582.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, yeah, I did see. Yeah, right. And oh, my God. Yes. Incredibly cursed content.
Yeah. Well, I found a quick Wikipedia paragraph on this. I think is worth reading because it was like a circumcision knife to the soul. This surname E. Humayun was which is some kind of Ottoman art, was commissioned for a circumcision festival. As well, it was to commemorate Sultan Murad III's son, Prince Mehmed. This festival lasted 52 days and was probably one of the most elaborate and grandiose festivals the Ottomans ever held, and it was well documented. The organization of the surnam was done chronologically, each day documented what occurred. The book was, anyways, yeah, but a 52-day circumcision festival. A 52-day circumcision festival.
Well, I mean, that's basically what we live in right now, right?
5-day circumcision festival, yes.
When Iranian conspiracy theorists, when Persian conspiracy theorists try and tell me that the Ottoman Empire was actually a secretly Jewish empire, that makes me believe them. that actually makes me believe them.
Oh, then maybe a potential other show title, right? Like the circumcision festivals will continue until morale improves.
That's just depressing, but yes, until morale hits rock bottom, maybe.
Yeah, we're not doing that title.
But no, I just stumbled across this article. Really, it was just kind of like happenstance, like shitpost, you know, from a time capsule of 20 years ago. And so the title of the article, and it's from the Winter 99/2000 Journal of Blacks in Higher Education, which is, you know, humorous in and of itself. But it's by Mr.
It's Rand. It's one of those oxymorons like military intelligence.
Hey-o. but it was just, who can say nigger?
A nigger.
And other considerations.
apparently Tucker Carlson and Frank can.
Yeah, but only them. But yeah, no, it was just a fun shit post, right? Like in a article form. It appears that Mr. Randall Kennedy is, some sort of high yellow, as best I could figure out. And, but just some of the highlights included: nigger is a key word in the lexicon of race relations and thus an important term in American politics. Cultural literacy demands knowledge of it. So just know, whenever you make an end tower, you're not being subversive. You are just becoming immersed in the cultural literacy, that Mr. Kennedy, demands that we possess. And it goes on.
I might actually start using that. I'm not racist. I'm culturally literate.
But yeah, and he goes on to say, what should it mean? Is nigger more or less hurtful as a racial epithet than competitors such as kike, wop, wetback, mick, chink, or gook? and then the highlight, right? Like the bit that they had on the front page where they'll often like put, a relevant quote, like a good eye-catching quote, for the article to draw you in. Just says, nigger is the all-American Trump card, the nuclear bomb of racial epithets. And anyway, there's not much to it, but just seeing, I guess at the sort of advent, the nascent stage of wokeness as we saw it, in early 2000, late 99, somebody doing attempting to do an academic breakdown, of the word of power, as I like to call it. It was, gave me no end of holiday cheer. So yeah, just remember, it's the all American Trump card.
Well, this is what I imagine. If anyone ever plays D&D, there's a spell called Power Word Kill. That's what I imagine what the actual word is.
But no, that was, that was sort of just an incidental, incidental shit post, I guess, while I was trying to find like other information. If you guys do want to look it up, read it on your own time, do a dramatic reading of it. Like I said, it's called Who Can Say Nigger? ... I think he used ellipses very incorrectly here in other considerations.
Nigger.
Well, yeah, DK, confirmed academic.
Yeah.
We might have an actual show title here. Power Word Chimp Out.
That's fantastic. I found the webpage of the JBHE, the Journal of Blacks in Higher Education. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to like kind of lowbrow content, but if you look at the banner, like, oosh, you can't do better than that. I just like, I don't know, man. I don't know.
A nigger.
Well, do you guys, do you want to talk about Christmas specials or do you want to get into what you're doing, Rabbi?
Oh, I say, because we could probably wax poetic entirely too long about the Christmas specials.
I think that one would actually be short because it's just it's kind of short and sweet, to be honest. The other one is much longer because I did some research into that one. So
I got you. All right, yeah, let's attack that one first then.
All right, Christmas specials. All right, so this is from Tablet Mag. Why I Won't Let My Kids Watch That Very Special Christmas Episode by Stuart Halperin. Stuart Halperin, Rabbi Dr. Stuart Halperin, is senior advisor to the provost of Yeshiva University and senior program officer of YU's Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. His edited books include the recently released Esther in America, the first full-length treatment of the Megillah's interpretation in and impact of the United States, as well as Gleanings, Reflections on Ruth, and Proclaim Liberty Throughout the Land, the Hebrew Bible in the United States.
Ew, he's Jewish?
Thank you. If modern orthodoxy is supposed to be about reconciling Jewish tradition and the culture at large, I think I'm a pretty decent product of its community. I can recite Rambam, but also Role Models, a film that has earned a little love from critics, let alone rabbis. I often confound students at Yeshiva University with a short sermon or six on Anchorman, 30 Rock, or whatever recent obsession my wife and I happen to pursue on Netflix. Cue the open mouth soy jack. And I've passed this Talmudic obsession with the minutiae of our entertainment onto my children, who spend more time than I care to admit basking in Bubble Guppies, the Octonauts, and myriad happy, shiny shows that give them as much pleasure as I get from laughing at, or is it with, Liz Lemon.
If I could interject really quickly, one, I love where this is going, but also this is just another great sign. Like, don't send your kids to college. This is the kind of folks that are teaching them.
Well, don't send them to Yeshiva University. I would also be. If you're sending your kids to Yeshiva University, you have other issues.
Oh, man. Well, maybe they're going full crypto, right? Like going full, if you can't infiltrate the GOP, you know, infiltrate Yeshiva, however the hell you pronounce it. Go a step farther.
There's only one I can't endorse to defeat the Jew. You must become the Jew. But there's only one exception to our devouring love of pop products. When their favorite shows present a Christmas episode, we insist that our children, as Liz would say, shut it down. Just gonna let that one linger for a second.
Memes becoming reality.
Yep. I understand that this may strike many as absolutely bananas. Am I afraid that some cartoon reindeer will inspire my precious Jewish children to run to the nearest church and forgo our local shul? Do I believe for one moment that Will Ferrell's shiny green jacket and yellow pants and elf will influence my 7-year-old to rip off his zitsies and dress instead like he was straight out of the North Pole? Or am I some kind of Grinch whose heart, being two sizes too small, begrudges billions of Christians worldwide the validity and profundity and beauty of their belief? So already we're getting into the chutzpah of this, where implying that all those things weren't created by Jews themselves or final Semites.
Well, one, to answer his rhetorical question, I'm leaning towards the latter. Yeah, that he wants to deny the meaning of Christmas and the beauty of it. Yes. And then secondly, yes, his heart may have shrunk two sizes, but I think that extra heart size went straight to his nose.
Control F Jesus. Does Jesus appear anywhere in this article? No, he does not appear to appear anywhere in this article.
What does Jesus have to do with Christmas? With Jewish Christmas, I guess. Anyway, yes.
The answer, thankfully, is none of the above. I don't let my kids watch Christmas shows for a much simpler reason. It's because I believe in diversity and believe differences matter and should be preserved, and believe that the best way to reach something approaching a universal worldview is to root it in the very specific details of my own particular tradition. And my tradition is Hanukkah, which I don't want my kids to confuse with any other holiday.
Huh. Well, there's a lot to unpack there.
Would you like me to read that again? To really let that sink in?
Yeah, let's
do it.
Yes.
The answer, thankfully, is none of the above. I don't let my kids watch Christmas shows for a much simpler reason. It's because I believe in diversity and believe that differences matter and should be preserved, and believe that the best way to reach something approaching a universal worldview is to root it in the very specific details of my own particular tradition. And my tradition is Hanukkah, which I don't want my kids to confuse with any other holiday.
So can I jump in here for a second?
Please, by all means.
So, okay. So there's an easy low hanging fruit here, right? Which is, you know, he says he believes in diversity. Obviously, he doesn't, because he doesn't believe in diversity for white people. Okay, that's low-hanging fruit. And it should be made. I just made it. Okay, there's a more interesting thing going on here, which I'm going to do a Talmudry. Okay, so notice what he says here. He says, I believe that the best way to reach something approaching a universal worldview is to root it in the very specific details of my own particular tradition. Now, there's, if you want to be what's called, you know, you could use a hermeneutic of generosity in reading this. What he's saying is something that I could actually agree with, which is, if you want to achieve a kind of global wisdom, a kind of, you know, generalized universal worldview, as he says, you need to have some kind of grounding in a particular tradition. You can't approach, you know, the problem of universal knowledge from, like, you know, like just getting, trying to get everything at once. It's never going to work. You have to have a very concrete particular knowledge and then use that as a foundation for your kind of more general view. That's true. But I don't think this Mr. Rabbi here deserves a hermeneutic of generosity. So I'm going to approach this with a hermeneutic of suspicion. And I'm going to note that there is another way grammatically, equally grammatically valid, to read this exact sentence. And I think that I don't care about his intention. I care about the fact that this is a grammatically valid interpretation. And I care about the fact is, I think this is, despite himself, what he is revealing in the text in writing this particular sentence in this particular way. Because there's another way, as I said, to interpret this. He says, I believe that the best way to reach something approaching a universal worldview is to root it in the very specific details of my own particular tradition. In other words, the way to have a universal worldview, a worldview for the whole world universally, is to root it in the details of his, Mr. Rabbi's, particular tradition, i.e. Judaism. What he is saying here, another way to read this exact same sentence, grammatically valid, is that he's not saying that in order for anyone in general to have a universal worldview, a correct, you know, kind of broad worldview, they need first to understand who they are and where they come from in and of themselves and their own ethnic and religious background. No, what he's saying is we will enslave the entire world under the yoke of Zionism, because that is how we get everybody on the same page.
Fucking kike.
And that's perfectly valid Talmudic interpretation of that sentence.
I am 100% on board with the hermeneutics of Zionist suspicion.
Oh, another man. Another strong show title contender.
No, I can't even do the that's bullshit, but I believe it, because no, that's truth and I believe
that's it. I have enough, academic training that, like, I mean, that would never ever pass, you know, I would instantly be like, but like, yeah, you could, I mean, that very method that I just applied, you read stuff, you'll see it all over the place. That's a very, very classical academic style analysis of a text. That's, I mean, I just did something they do all the time.
Well, I think I'm about to give you some more opportunities here. So, in a culture dedicated to advocating openness, open minds, open hearts, open borders, this statement might strike you as well just a bit too closed off. Do we really need to be so jarring and so firm in our Jewish difference when the calendar offers an annual anchor in which such a wide swath of Americans who are so diverse in all matters, political, economic, and social, can put aside their distinctions in digital bloviating and find a sliver of communal commonality? After all, would it really be that hard to put up some red, layer on some white, pick up some shiny bulbs, and pick up a non-threatening mid-sized shrub for the living room? You need to pick up a cross too, by the way. But that's exactly the point. It wouldn't be hard at all. Like so many of the opportunities America provides, it would be as simple as pressing the big red Staples button. It would be wonderfully uncomplicated to chow down on whatever I want in whatever restaurant I wanted. It would have been nice if the Gentile girl next door was a dating
app. Oh, there we go. There it is. Sorry, go on.
It would be so gosh darn simple for my ears to bask in the audio glow of Mariah Carey singing to me about all it is that she wants for Christmas. These facile pleasures have been the precise and constant challenges facing us American Jews. There has been an unstated national presumption, sometimes even stated, that graduating from one's backward-looking traditions and drinking from the goblet of cosmopolitanism makes one truly American. The pull of the cushioned rope of assimilation can beckon ever so convincingly. After all, one would be in the company of a Pulitzer Prize-winning Jewish author, which is Michael Chabon, if you believed in abhorring homogeneity and insularity, exclusion and segregation, the redlining of neighborhoods, the erection of border walls, and separation barriers between Jews and their fellow countrymen. No less a towering figure than Eleanor Roosevelt, that matriarch of American morality, once lamented that the difficulty is that the country is still full of immigrant Jews, very unlike ourselves. I don't blame them for being as they are. I know what they've been through in other lands, and I'm glad they have freedom at last, and I hope they'll have the chance among us to develop all there is in them. But it takes a little time for Americans to be made. If one's entire framework of being is to be American, there's no reason not to embrace all of this country's aesthetic, cultural, and even spiritual offerings. Isn't it icky and embarrassing to have to stick out as different, you might argue? Isn't love love? Aren't barriers bad? These questions aren't easy to answer, nor, mind you, are they new. As early as Abraham, Jews were constantly asked to pick up and put themselves on the other end of the river at an angle to the rest of mankind, fundamentally at odds with the culture. To become a Jew has meant to be alienated from the rest of society, wrote the 20th century theologian Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, whatever.
Kike, kike,
the destiny, kike. The destiny of Avraham HaEvri, the lonely Abraham, has always accompanied the Jew. After all, the Almighty himself is the lonely one. Each individual should possess the strength to pitch his tent on one bank of the river while society lives on the other. Now, it hardly takes a rabbinic genius to realize that this statement presents its share of problems. If Jews are forever apart, can we ever truly become American? Or are we, like some of our most nefarious haters have often accused us of being, perpetual strangers who can never really fit in? Louis Brandeis addressed this question straight on. A man, he wrote, is a better citizen of the United States for being also a loyal citizen of his state and of his city, for being loyal to his family and to his profession or trade, for being loyal to his college or lodge, and will likewise be a better man and a better American for doing so. He was merely repurposing one of Judaism's most ancient bits of insight for a modern age. Universalism is too vague an abstraction. You can only truly belong to a larger collective if you are first rooted in a specific tradition of your own. Put bluntly, it's precisely apartness that makes our togetherness possible.
I'm sorry. This makes me spitting mad. Like, that's just Aristotle. Like, get the fuck out of here. This is exactly the kind, when they talk about like, this is the kind, exactly the thing like Judeo-Christian or like the foundations of, you know, Western civilization are, you know, Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem. It's like, one of these things is not like the other. Kike.
If apartness makes our togetherness possible, then apart yourself as far away from me.
That's the way to really be together, is for like, you need to be really far away apart from me. Yes.
I want to go. Find your poem in accessibility to me.
But yeah, just in general, right? Like the fact that in one sentence, you know, he gives five words talking about diversity and how it's cool and everything, and then proceeds to give me like 3,000 words talking about how, oh, but you know, not for me, not for my household, not for my kids. Like, dude, piss off.
All right, so which brings me back to my kids and why they know to skip that bit where the Octonauts submarine reaches the North Pole during that very special holiday episode. The recently departed and sorely missed Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks taught us that pride in our unique traditions, to the exclusion of those of others but not to their detriment, can be a lesson in the dignity of difference. That Hanukkah occurs in winter, that it happens in proximity to that other big holiday, gives us Jewish parents an opportunity to remind our children again of the beauty and necessity of our boundaries, of who we are and why we are this way, and of why we have no interest in picking up the traditions, even the holly jolly ones, of our Gentile friends and neighbors. By doing so, by delighting in Maccabees and latkes and dreidels rather than reveling in Dancer and Prancer and Rudolph, we do not shut ourselves in or lock ourselves out. Instead, we pridefully shine a light of our own and remind others that this is what real diversity looks like. Not a mishmash of interchangeable ideas that all look and feel the same, but a mosaic of unique and distinct traditions coming together under one glorious tent. And if you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish just like you and me.
Oh, a list of Jews. Actually, I'm interested in that.
You're just making a list of Jews.
Yeah, Borzo, you really, I mean, I you were... You have a more finely tuned Judar, I think, than I do. You early on called it about the, like, there was no mention of Christ at all in this. Yep. And I, like, that to me is really, I mean, notice.
I'm well versed in like very subtle, like microaggressions.
Yes.
Against us. I'm very well versed in this because he completely takes the Christmas tradition and infantilizes it completely down to it being basically Rankin Bass animations.
So notice here, I'm going to do another hermeneutics of Zionist suspicion. Notice here how, He knows he's done quite a bit to piss a certain kind of people off. Not even just us. Obviously he's gonna, you know, he knows us, but I mean, they're like a certain kind of normie Christian could read this and, you know, they're gonna have mixed feelings because on the one hand, they, you know, they're kind of generally pro-Semitic by default. On the other hand, they're kind of like, but it's, I mean, they maybe want to be respectful, but they're also kind of like, why is he, you know, there's something about it that's making them uneasy. They don't necessarily know what it is. Is he has framed this discussion in a way that precludes the idea, like he mentions Christmas trees and tinsel and all this garbage bullshit. He doesn't mention a nativity scene. He doesn't mention a creche. He doesn't mention an angel on the tree. He doesn't mention, you know, any of that. It's completely missing from the discussion. So the pushback is entirely going to be in, like, you know, in this direction that benefits him of, you know, when you push back against his perspective, it's going to be like, yeah, but, you know, what about Rudolph? It's not going to be like, what about baby Jesus in the manger?
Yeah. No, he's created a strong
he, I absolutely think he knows that. He's doing that intentionally, 100%.
Well, and Louis Condi in the chat says they can't name him. It grates them. I've seen it happen IRL. They clench their jaw at his name. I 100% believe that.
I believe it too.
Well, what is it in a lot of like Talmudic writings and what have you? They'll refer to him passive aggressively as like the carpenter or the Nazarene or something like that. You know, they're just such passive aggressive little assholes, right? They can't even name the dude they hate.
DK might know this. I'm pretty sure you don't know this, Bellerophon, I'm not trying to say anything with that, but do you guys know about the Jewish plus sign, right?
Yes.
Oh, the circle bit?
Well, that's, okay, so you know about the Keikel thing, where that came from. No.
I thought that's what you were talking about. Oh, yeah, they have their own plus sign. Yes, I did, yes, in Jewish mathematics, yeah.
Yeah. Bellerophon, they have their own plus sign in mathematics. So it's the plus sign with the top cut off, so it looks more like a T, because they refuse to make the plus sign because it's a cross.
This is the kind of thing where it's like, you know, because you just don't see these hangups in it, like, okay, I'm not, you know, and I've gotten pushback from people who are, you know, more woke on the MQ, the Muslim question, that, you know, and don't get me wrong, I'm, you know, but like, Islam regards Jesus as a major prophet. That's, you know, a certain kind of blasphemy from a Christian perspective, but you're not going to see Muslims just shitting on Jesus and doing this kind of thing.
I got it wrong, by the way. It's the bottom
upside, the bottom part that's missing. Yeah. And you know, you don't see that in Asia either. And you know, I've seen Hindus, you know, incorporate Jesus into their basically they worship Ganesh, they worship Shiva, they worship Jesus, you know, they put Jesus in the little thing. I've seen that with my own eyes. So like this is the kind of thing where like I just have a hard time at a certain level even just processing it, because I get not being Christian, I get not having faith in the sense of, you know, There's a God that's an ultimate creator God, and he incarnated in this particular way in this particular time, and we should, you know, we can engage. Okay, the whole Christian theological thing. I get not necessarily accepting that. I don't understand. I have never understood. I could never understand not loving Jesus. I just, you know, whatever you want to say, whatever, however you want to interpret the events, you want to say, like, even, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson and these kind of deist types, you know, they want to deny Christ's humanity. They want to, you know, physically remove the references to miracles from the Bible, but they still want, you know, and this is a kind of default shit lib line to a large extent to this day. I mean, it's kind of changing in some ways, but, you know, I don't believe in Jesus, but you should be more like him because we see something we like in him. He was a great moral teacher, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you know, I don't care who you are. I don't care what religion you are. You should be able at a human level to love and respect Jesus. I think that's very simple. I don't think that's a high bar to clear. And yet there's one group of people that's just constitutionally incapable of clearing it. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, this remind, like, this is this level of like just like pettiness is quite jaw dropping. I did not know that Borzoi about the plus sign thing, right? Like wanting to avoid even making the sign of the cross. Like, this is a level of petty that would make like middle school girls blush.
And I want to point out to somebody in the chat was saying that they knew Jewish mathematicians. I've never known. Yeah, that's to be clear, like, that's like an ultra orthodox thing. And that's if you want to see the largest levels of Jewish pettiness on the theological level towards Christ, you gotta go to the ultra orthodox. There's enough, you know, there's various varieties of Jewish theology where you're gonna see that kind of spectrum on it. But the fact that it exists reveals the extent to which they can be petty, because you will not find that from any other group of people.
It is petty, but I want to emphasize it's also completely hateful. Like, it's not just, yes, it is petty, it is mean, it is small-souled, it is all of those things. But it's so, I mean, can you imagine basing your identity around hating someone like that? I especially, like, you know, whether you want to say Jesus is the Son of God or not, like someone who, for like the entire rest of the planet, is, you know, like, this is the perfect human. This is someone who lived, you know, the perfect life, who, you know, okay, whatever you want to say about him theologically, it's like, this is someone we should all and are all capable of looking up to because of his message, because of everything else. No, we hate him. We hate what he stood for. We hate what he did. We hate, I mean, I'm getting kind of like worked up inside. It's making me like, I mean, viscerally, not even just angry, like sad and depressed, thinking about what, how warped does your mind have to be to hate Jesus like that?
Yeah. And that's, and I point, that doesn't matter how widespread it is. The fact that they are capable of it, because you have to remember, these are also people that always talk, and, you know, if there's one person who's anti-Semitic, then there's a whole, to them, there's a whole people who are anti-Semitic. And that's the way they view things. And so you have to view things through that lens. So if they are, you know, if they are capable of being that small souled in terms of hatred for Christ, then that's like that potential exists within all of them.
Anyway,
sorry, Jews. Yeah. Sorry, Jews. You made the rules. I'm just playing by them.
Well, it also goes to show you, those are the people who are the most invested in Jewish identity, like the most hardcore people about like what a Jew is and what it means to be Jewish are the ones who are most invested in hating Jesus. That tells you something for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and also, this is old news at this point, right? What was it, 4, 5, 6 years ago? You know, Sarah Silverman, who, you know, is, you know, ethnically of the tribe, but if memory serves, is just kind of a cosmopolitan secular Jew.
She's even said some anti-Israel policy stuff as well, because she plays that role too. So, yeah.
But yeah, did she, you know, she had some edgy stand up bit, right, where she remarked about how, yeah, if I could go back in time, I'd kill Jesus again. It, something to that flavor. Like, yeah, maybe she doesn't do the plus sign thing. Maybe she's not invested in all the tokenisms of, you know, hating on this worldwide religion, you know, hating on, as DK was saying, you know, a guy that in a more charitable view, even if you're not Christian, you could just view as somebody who is a good moral teacher. If you want to take it that route, you know, somebody who's good, aspirational, source of a few good quotes to make you a better person, you know, like even the secular ones seem to have just a deep, deep hatred of Jesus, of Christianity, the whole nine yards.
I just came up with possibly a clever troll. If anyone ever gets a chance to talk, like, it, and they talk to Ben Shapiro at some kind of question and answer thing. DK, I can't remember if you were on this episode. Do you guys remember when Ben Shapiro had that weird thing about talking about baby Hitler, that it would be immoral?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. If I don't remember.
The liberals were really mad about that and all that. And Shapiro said something to the extent of, it's like wrong to kill baby Hitler because.
Yeah, he's like, abortion is bad, was the take. Yes.
It's a baby. Well, I would be interested if somebody asked, if somebody would ask Ben Shapiro if he would save baby Jesus from Herod.
Yeah.
Curious to see how he would react to that.
I think you'd have to get him off camera for his real reaction, yeah. But yes.
But even on stage, like, I just to watch him fluster and sweat, because like he would never expect a question like that.
No, of course not. Yeah. Whew.
But if we're talking about Jewish insanity, do you want to talk about what you're doing, Rabbi?
Oh, hell yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes, please. This was confirmation bias dialed up to 10.
This is okay. So, and people might have followed this. I'm just going to read the New York Post article first because it's short and it's hilarious. So yeah, there were some synagogues that were being vandalized, and immediately all of our guys jumped to conclusions on what happened. And of course, because there are guys, they were immediately right. Like, the great thing about this scene is you can just assume what happens, and all you have to do is wait for the evidence to prove you right.
Man. Yeah, well, didn't you reference the other week that, like, you know, anon frog accounts have a better track record, you know, for the past 4 or 5 years of anticipating public events more than CNN, more than the professionals ever have?
If you were to make predictions based off of following completely schizophrenic Twitter accounts or what CNN is reporting, you will have a better chance of being right with the former. But man accused of vandalizing 4 NYC synagogues charged with hate crime. A Brooklyn man was charged with a hate crime Thursday for allegedly desecrating four synagogues last week, police said. Emil Benjamin, 39, is accused of vandalizing the four houses of worship in Midwood with graffiti last Saturday, authorities said. The targeted synagogues were Kahal Darkei Noam on Avenue J, Young Israel Senior Services of Midwood on Ocean Avenue, Kahal
Wait, did Torah, you say Avenue J?
Yeah. Cal... Sorry. Call Torres Chaim de Flatbush on Avenue L and Knesset Bias Avigdor on Avenue J, police said. Here's the depth of pettiness here. At the last location, Benjamin allegedly broke into the synagogue, graffitied the inside, broke two cabinets, and swiped $20, police said. In case you weren't sure what his actual ethnicity was. Not only did he vandalize the synagogues, but he stole $20 too. Like,
oh, that's delightful. Also, can I just make a bold? This is a bold hot take here. I think he did it right at the end of the year because they were looking over their books and they were like, "We got to write off some of these expenses. We need to make an insurance claim so we don't owe any taxes. Can somebody come by and just rough up the place a little bit?" I'm gonna say it's a bold insurance grift scam just at the end of the year so they can get it on their books.
Cops said the graffiti at all the synagogues included derogatory phrases but didn't elaborate. So, first of all, interesting thing with this is that he's being charged with a hate crime. Now, what will probably happen is they just did that for the headline because of how embarrassing this is. This guy is so obviously Jewish. It's so obviously what you do in rabbi situation. But they need to, they obscure what he, who he is. They don't talk about other details about him, and they're slapping with a hate crime charge. That will probably be dropped down the line once the story quietly leaves the news, which it already kind of is. That's only people like us that are following it. So there's first that, and that's how they're going to keep juking up this hate crime stuff where they'll just commit hate crimes against themselves, and then, they'll count based off of when the charges are applied, and then they'll just quietly drop the charges. And that's how it's going to be. Like, that's how they're going to do it this decade. It's so obviously what their playbook is going to be. But here's the other thing about him. Now, there's no proof this is the same guy, but he does share the same name, looks a lot like him, and they're both from New York City. So I'm going to assume it's probably him. People found Emil Benjamin's IMDb. He's a wannabe media guy. He's a director of short films, and he's got he's got at least one interesting short film here. So he's got a short film called Derailing. He's got a short film called Death Wish. He's got a short film called The Breakdown Parables. He's got a short film called We Can Do It, and he's got a short film called White People. I found White People online. I watched it, and I think it would be interesting to play it. It's only about, in terms content-wise, it's only about 6 minutes long. I'll narrate a little bit of what's going on here for the since a lot of people are going to be hearing this after the fact. I think it's worth getting into, though, to see.
Maybe we get to watch a movie in class.
Yes, it's movie day at the Third Rail.
Oh my goodness! I'm looking at the still shot from this. He's in white face.
Yes. So first of all. On the thumbnail, you have one of the characters who is a white. Well, I don't know who the actor is. A person of light skin who's, however, wearing very white chalk face, doing a blackface type thing. So already we have this. Now let me read the. Let me read to you what the synopsis of White People is. Having been rejected from all the universities he applied for. Young Axel must vie for his father's approval by helping him carry out an egregious act in this absurdist meditation on first world hypocrisies. All right. I'm going to ask you to pause a couple times, Frank, because I'm going to point some stuff out as we're watching this. But let me go over. Okay, go ahead, Frank.
Das Sein selbst hat sich in dieser Hinsicht für den Menschen bisher
I can't read that. So pause that for a second there. So I wasn't sure who was speaking at first. I'm going to read what that said. Being itself has been hidden from the human being. And the second line is, I had to pull it myself. And that is why we now have to ask the question. to get an answer on what and who is the human being. Okay. So, anyone want to take a guess at who was that speaking in German?
Goebbels.
Nope. Martin Heidegger.
Fucking based. Oh. Even more based.
But it's an interesting choice. No, Martin Heidegger was a member of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, philosopher.
He's the godfather and really grandfather and in some ways just father of, like, he is 20th century continental philosophy, and it's all just kind of his students and theirs and the students of his students.
And
I meant rather that, you know, since he was quoting Heidegger, you know, is he secretly a base self-hating Jew? What's going on here?
No,
he's straight up German. No, okay, yeah. So Martin Heidegger was like straight up German. He was a Lutheran. He was going into to do
no,
Lutheran.
But Bill Blitzant's asking about the filmmaker. He's asking about Heidegger in there. What he's doing is, like, this is a very subtle anti-white film. And I looked at some of the stuff that are the references that are in this. So first of all, if people don't know this, Jews have been seething about the fact that academia cannot ignore an unpersoned Martin Heidegger. They seethe over this because that's how influential Heidegger was. They've tried to diminish him as much as possible because of him being a member of the National Socialist Party in Germany. But
it's not just that. I know personally I know a grad student who was working in philosophy who had intended to study to work on Heidegger because this person was very, very just like liked Heidegger a lot. And when because it was known that he was a member of the NSDAP. It was known that he had he was sort of like ambivalent in certain respects, but then but it was sort of an open question, or people just assumed that he wasn't really ideologically on board, that he wasn't, you know, super enthusiastic. It was just sort of, and it's true, at the time, you, in order to advance, in order to occupy the kind of prestigious posting that he occupied, you had to be a member in good standing of the party. But then his personal notebooks, called the Black Books, were published relatively recently. And in his personal writings that were never published or hadn't been published, he was basically like, no, he's a straight up, like, ideological, hardcore National Socialist, like, no ambiguity about it. And this person was really devastated by that and ended up taking their graduate work in a completely different direction. And I'm sure they're not alone in that. I think it's definitely a kind of open wound, but that's the thing is Heidegger was, I mean, Sartre was one of his disciples, Gadamer, who, you know, founded the hermeneutic, like all this stuff about hermeneutics, that's all Gadamer, who was the student of Heidegger. And Gadamer's students include Derrida and a million other people. Like, this is like the origin of everything you think of as being 20th century continental philosophy really is Heidegger. And it's a really difficult topic for them.
Okay. Now we can resume watching white people now.
Was und wer der Mensch ist.
Yale. Rejected. Harvard. Rejected. Princeton. Rejected. Columbia. Cambridge. Oxford. Dartmouth. Penn. Cornell. What's this, Brown? Even the peasants won't keep your company, you little cock smuggler.
There's still Georgetown.
Oh, Georgetown. Hey, Jim, did you hear my half-retarded son got into Georgetown? We're going to go start shopping for crayons. Fuck!
Uncle Henry, get to Georgetown.
So, Georgetown, if people don't know, that's a school in Washington, D.C. It was founded by Jesuits. It's known for being a Catholic school. So already you have like the very – you're going to hear a little bit more subtle anti-Christian stuff in here as well. But you have also the way that they're – this is his conceptualization of what white people are, which you can tell is also just a projection of their – own, you know, of their own Jewishness in terms of the people who are making this. But so we got that so far. So far we have a thing about Heidegger. We have Georgetown being referenced derisively. Continue. We also get the chalk face type stuff.
The lawyer for a goddamn non prophet! You listen to me. This is it. You don't get into Georgetown and you're out of here. You can forget about the car, the company, the trust. Hell, you can forget about a fucking roof. Oh, goddamn motherfucking goddamn shit. Hey, bunny. Yeah. Good. Good. Oh, just, you know, a little quality time with the bambino. Talking about school.
So this is the Coventry Carol. This is a very this is a classic, famous Anglican hymn.
You know, this is the white man's struggle. If our son was black or something, oh, honey, don't you worry. Yeah, we're gonna have a little chat about responsibility.
So pause right there. So now you have this father complaining about the fact that that they have it worse than the black man. That if he was black, his son could get into schools. Which, you know, where's the lie? But this is meant to be, so people who can't see this. This is being juxtaposed by the fact that they have a beaten and bound man who's struggling on the floor of their nice living room while he's on the phone, being very. It's like the banality of evil type thing, where they're complaining about their quote unquote first world problems while they are engaged in active violence against another person. As Johnny Real 242 says, I'm getting Tay-Sex from looking at this. But again, like, a lot of this stuff is projection as well, with the references to becoming a lawyer for a nonprofit. Who actually does that stuff? We know the answer to that. But this is maybe just because, like, this is my art background and all this stuff. Like, it made me, I went insane from looking at this because I see what he's doing. Continue.
Okay. Love you too. Bye now.
Dad? Is that the Princeton guy?
Ah, shit.
Princeton's like 20% Jewish, by the way, at least.
What are you gonna do? Call the cops, you pussy?
Now we have a bunch of really bad film school type cliches and stock type shots. You have the father suffocating the Princeton guy with a pillow with one of those banal expressions. I forgot what it said, but something like to the effect of, you know, home is the people you live with or whatever.
Fuck yeah.
Oh no, it was the son that did that. I couldn't tell. Yeah, what I love most about my home is whom I share it with. They've been clearly hacking the guy to pieces.
You were okay at tennis.
Tennis? I love tennis. I love you. I love tennis. I love playing tennis. I love tennis balls. I love tennis. I love you, tennis.
So you have this conception of rich white or of privileged white people being these, like especially men being these pathetic pansies that are desperate for their father's approval. So you got that going on here.
Yeah, and if I could interject really quickly as well, I tried to pull it up while we're talking, and I couldn't find the exact still shot. But when the gentleman from Princeton, you know, who was crawling around the floor, clearly been like bound and gagged, and I guess you know, punished by the father for not accepting his son into the school. And when he looked up to the camera, you know, bloody and hair matted and everything, that reminded me of a beat almost precisely from The Passion of the Christ. I don't know if that was accidental or anything
that. He chose the Coventry Carol, and there's all kinds of references to, like, subtle references to Christianity in throughout this piece, because this is his, supposedly his, like, absurdist conception of white people. And because this guy's not, he's just a talentless hack Jew, it's so over the top. And even when he thinks he's being subtle, you can pick up on what he's doing.
Yeah. And the somebody remarked in the chat, right, regarding American Psycho. Like, yeah, I mean, we've seen this spiel done before 20 years ago with American Psycho, and actually done with a little bit of grace. And I don't know, done in a way that was actually interesting. This is just the equivalent of hitting you over the head with a frying pan.
Yeah, it's American Psycho trying to make Patrick Bateman into a WASP Al Jolson.
Oh, hot take. But anyway, that was sorry for interrupting. That's all I got on it.
Nope, there's not much to say about it. But yeah, we're almost at the end here of this thing.
Now let's remove the Jews.
This is my family and my house. See, this is my dad.
Oh, you found me.
Pretty cool, huh? This is just my dad being proud of me, because I did it. I didn't get into college, but I did do it.
He's such a kid. You're such a kid, Dad. You're so confused. You're so confused. You're so
confused. So, doing a parody of, like, Goofy Home Videos. Juxtaposed with the dead Princeton guy, and the father's disapproving face becoming approval. Now they're digging a hole on the beach to bury the Princeton guy.
The son is vomiting.
Yep. You know, it's meant to express guilt of what he has become. Guilt and disgust.
I didn't get into Georgetown.
Father slaps and spits on him and walks away.
You little faggot. I knew we never should have had you. You're nothing but a waste of money. You'll never make money. You'll never be a businessman. You fucking suck. Your mother doesn't love you. You stick at sports. You have a small prick with the
Now the son goes to grab the shovel, and the cycle of white violence perpetuates itself, of white seething resentment because small pee-pee.
Real projection hours.
Yes. And that is the film White People.
Well, you know what?
I missed that the first time I saw it. With the Germanic font, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was going to say, if I made short films that shitty, yeah, I'd probably lash out as well. So yeah, maybe cut the guy a little bit of slack.
So this obviously nobody paid any money to.
He's got his own media company, hilariously called Irrelevant Media.
I mean, okay. Points for self-awareness, even if it's ironic and seething with, you know, hatred and so on. I'm just wondering, like, what is he, like, a trust fund kid, or like people who, how does he make these, and what is his source of income?
He has to be from some kind of privileged family, or
I have to assume, right?
So, listen to this, because I found his LinkedIn. Emil was raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and earned his BFA in theater arts from Boston University. Studied physical theater at Accademia dell'Arte in Arezzo, Italy. So he got to study in fucking Italy.
Oh my God.
And currently resides in New York City, where he's built an eclectic career as an interdisciplinary artist, advocate, and entrepreneur. Remember, this guy's also 39 years old. Grown-ass man.
But performative, what did you call the situationism? Is performative lollygagging or whatever?
Politicized lollygagging.
Politicized lollygagging, yes. Yeah. Definitely a situationist.
After spending a few years writing and directing for the stage and acting in regional plays and on national television, Emil made his first foray into filmmaking with Derailing, a short film that led – that's not about the third rail, by the way – a short film that led to him to more work as a director and or cinematographer on a number of short films and other video projects. Eventually, he was accepted into Columbia University, where he pursued an MFA in film and taught undergraduate screenwriting. His films White People and We Can Do It have screened at a dozen film festivals around the world, taking home prizes and nominations, as well as distribution on platforms like Indio. He's currently in post-production on a documentary feature film about the Lakota Nation, featured in DOC NYC's Only in New York program, on which he served as a co-director, co-producer, cinematographer, and editor. Emil is the founder of Irrelevant Media, a media company and artist collective made up of people working in narrative film, documentary, commercial, web, digital content, music, and podcasting. He's trying to break into our business. But yeah, so I'm looking at some of his education. So he's got a bartender certification, apparently. Labyrinth Theater Ensemble Workshop, Academia dell'Arte, Boston University, Columbia University in the city of New York. He was an artistic intern at the Huntington Theater Company, an assistant front office manager at Boston University School of Theater, director instructor at Boston University Summer Theaters Institute, managing director at the Codis Rosso Theater, self-employed theater artist.
None of this shit pays anything. Sorry, is that the end of the?
Oh, last one. Actor for Don Buchenwald and Associates.
Okay.
Commercial division.
None of that pays anything. So I'm gonna make here's a series of snap judgment calls that we'll see how this goes. So I'm gonna say number one that this dude's a fucking retard, which is obvious. I mean, if you're spray painting swastikas on synagogues, you're clearly like not the brightest bulb. Arts programs are notorious for, I mean, no offense, Borzo, but I'm sure you're aware of, like, you know, you get brilliant people.
I'll tell you stories someday about when I was in theater.
Yeah. So you get some brilliant people for sure, but you also get people that like are neither good at math nor at English. So, take that for what it may be worth. I'm going to go ahead and say he comes from family money. His father's probably, you know, reasonably or quite, perhaps extreme. I mean, if you can send your kid to study, theater in Italy, as an undergrad, clearly you have money. So his father probably is a practical person, maybe in finance. That would fit his ethnic background, but who knows, really, law, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Point is, it's probably something real. His father's probably an actual serious person, which means he looks at his like retard faggot son. And he's like, why are you such a retarded faggot? Which accounts for the extreme enmity in the film depicted between the father and the son. I'm sure the monologue. Now he's maybe, you know, I think it's more a reflection of he's seeing probably in large part of his Jewish peers, but also actual white people, you know, goyish Gentiles, who, you know, come from New York money or whatever kind of money, I guess he grew up in Cleveland, but get rejected from all these prestigious schools or, you know, have trouble getting in without someone like Jared Kushner, you know, his father donating $6 million or however much to pull the strings for Harvard. Not everybody has $6 million just lying around. So they have this, this struggle in terms of their class. I also want to point in on this note of the father-son dynamic in the film and just generally, you know, there's a culture has a very famous story, really kind of an origin myth of their ethnicity, of themselves, that involves a father having like unaccountable homicidal impulses towards his son. That's Jews, right? That's the story of Abraham and Isaac. And that's extremely alien, completely foreign to Western Aryan European peoples, to the extent that it's something, you know, European peoples have been Christianized for quite a while. And that whole time we've struggled mightily with the story of Abraham and Isaac. It's something, and there are things you can do with it. Kierkegaard, you know, had a really, I don't know that you can really top his analysis in terms of trying to make sense, theological, sense of this extremely disturbing story, and you know, not to say there's no way out necessarily, but it's extremely alien. It is not alien to the Jews. That is their origin story. Is this father had this murderous rage, you know, he just wanted to murder his son, and that's your culture, Emil. That's not my culture. That's your ethnicity. That's not my people. That's your people. You did that. That's how you are. That's not how we are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's. I mean, we were talking about the binding of Isaac. I mean, you mentioned Kierkegaard. I mean, he in order to make sense of it, he had to write a whole philosophical work on it.
I mean, you could go on and on about like how do we like deal with this because it's a really big problem because that's not how we are. But it's how they are.
Also, I'm just morbidly curious too. Like, what? How could you send your kid off? You know, 4 years of college. Lord knows how many years of film school. You know, on a different continent, and this is the best they can come up with. Like, damn, dude. I'm just sort of. I think more than anything at the moment, I'm just thunderstruck by like the low quality subversion.
Well, Steve Saylor has written about this. How like, yeah, like I mean, at least the '60s Jews, you know, they were extremely subversive and responsible in many ways for our current degeneracy and all these problems. But you can't say they were dumb. Like Woody Allen is not a stupid person. These Jews in the universities and at the cultural forefront in the 1960s and '70s. Say whatever you want about them. They're not stupid. And I'm sure Mr. Benjamin's father is not a stupid man either. Emil is a retard. And yeah, in general, the quality, the intellectual quality of this current generation of Jews at the top of the pyramid is just pathetic.
Oh my God, there's more about this guy. Because I was looking at other articles. I found this guy, long track record. A Jew. So here's the proof, and not that we needed it, but New York Daily News, thank you very much. A Jewish Brooklyn man faces hate crime charges for allegedly scrawling messages on four synagogues and burglarizing one of them during an hour-long crime spree. He did that within an hour? Oh, my God.
That's pretty industrious.
I thought this was, like, drawn out. I didn't realize this all happened in the course of an hour. So Emil Benjamin was charged Thursday with burglary and criminal mischief as a hate crime in connection with the early Saturday spree. Benjamin told the Daily News in 2011 after he was stabbed on a Brooklyn subway platform that he's a Kavkazi Jew. I've never even heard of that.
By a white supremacist neo-Nazi, I'm sure.
5 years later, he was accused of stealing four Torah scrolls worth more than $200,000 from another synagogue in Midwood.
Whoa, wait, why do Torahs cost that much? Well, I don't know. Conversation for a different time.
I want you guys to hear what he's accused of writing on these synagogues, and we're gonna play a game called "One of These Things Is Not Like the Other." One of these things just doesn't belong. He's accused of writing pedophiles, thieves, and anti-acculturation on the front and sides of the buildings.
Well,
anti-acculturation.
He's not wrong on the first two. You know, 66%, two-thirds is a decent batting average. I'll give him that.
I mean, I know we got some. I know we got some pretty. It means like basically anti-assimilation. I know we got some pretty smart guys in our sphere. I don't know any neo-Nazi that would ever write anti-acculturation. Ever.
Like, what again? What the fuck does that even mean?
Is he saying that the Jews refuse to assimilate?
Well, okay. I mean, wrong.
So then on. Oh my God, this is so good. At the break-in at Kahal Darke Noam on Avenue J, Benjamin allegedly scrawled graffiti inside, damaged two cabinets, and stole $20, police said. Surveillance video from the Young Israel Midwood on Ocean Avenue near Avenue L shows the suspect walking up to the front of the synagogue and scrawling a message on the wall with two markers, one red, one white, police said. Very subtle, Emil. In the November 11, 2011 incident, Benjamin was beaten and stabbed by two men on southbound F train approaching a station at 4th Avenue and 9th, police said at the time. Then a loan broker living in Bensonhurst. So he's a loan broker too. Now we know where the money comes from. Then a loan broker living in Bensonhurst, Benjamin told the news his attackers yelled anti-Semitic slurs before the assault. They said, "You're nobody, you Jewish bastard," he said. You're nobody.
So I guess I'm a little unclear on this. So did these assaults actually happen, or is he just making false police reports?
I don't know, because that was from 2011.
I'm gonna say he's just making false police report. Like, this is all fan fiction. None of this ever happened.
Okay, here's I pulled up the article from that time. A Brooklyn man stabbed in a subway platform during a spat with two men said he had the upper hand until the toughs pulled out a blade. Emil Benjamin, 30, was on a southbound F train approaching a station at 4th Avenue when the two men started cursing him out with anti-Semitic slurs at about 9:40 p.m. Monday, he said. They said, "You're nobody, you Jewish bastard," Benjamin said. The men pounced, and Benjamin, a Kavkazi Jew, took punches all over his body that beat me up my head, breast, and chest.
None of this ever happened.
The doors opened and it spilled onto the platform, he said. They were on me from both sides. Benjamin, a loan broker from Bensonhurst, punched one of the brutes in the mouth, busting his lip open. But as the duo ran away, Benjamin felt something pouring down his back. I felt blood gushing out of my back and my left leg, he said. It was sizzling hot, like a hot shower. My blue jeans were red. My sneakers were soaked with blood. As bystanders called for help, Benjamin, who was stabbed in the back and left thigh, spotted a blood-soaked knife on the concrete platform. He was rushed to Lutheran Medical Center and cops busted the suspects nearby. Rafael Padi, 22, and Jose Santos, 18, were charged with assault. Well, there you go. There.
Okay.
So it did.
So there were actual real people, maybe.
Yeah. Padin, who sliced his own hand. I doubt these these ethnic gentlemen shouted, "You're nobody, you Jew bastard."
No way.
I doubt that.
Oh man, and I appreciate too that, you know, he can't just say in a matter of fact manner, right? Like as he's bleeding out, "Oh, I got stabbed in the back and thigh." He's got to jazz up the prose a little bit. He's got to say, "Oh, my jeans turned red. The blood was hot, you know, flowing down my back." You know, the failed novelist, the failed artist, you know, tries to you know, even spice up the prose for like a run of the mill medical report.
Do you guys know what the... Okay, yeah, all right. So listen to this. This is his 2016 arrest. Then on December 29th... What is it with him in Christmas crimes here? Then on December 29th, 2016, he was busted on charges that he burglarized the Avenue O synagogue in Midwood, cops said. According to a criminal complaint, he took 4 Torah scrolls worth more than $200,000. The scrolls were returned to the synagogue a few days later, according to a PIX11 report.
I want to know where the fence for stolen Torah scrolls is. Like, who do you sell that? Who's the like Jew who's so Jewy that he like Jews the Jews with the literal Torah? He's like, "Yeah, I'll buy that for you discount." I mean, not even Goy. Just, oh my God.
He pleaded guilty to petty larceny and got a conditional discharge in the case. So he didn't even get a grand larceny charge. Like $200,000 is grand larceny. He got petty larceny.
Damn, oh, man. Like... That's some high level nepotism right there.
I just want to know what he thought he was going to do. That's what with the scrolls. Like, who buys stolen Torah scrolls? Or is it just not even the point? I can't even. This guy clearly has issues.
Well, if you want to wonder where the intelligence is, because you kept calling him a retard. He's literally a mountain Jew. The Kavkazi Jews are the mountain Jews of the Caucasus Mountains.
What, like dwarves and Lord of the Rings, or what are we talking here?
Let me put it this way: this guy's probably closer to the to his ethnic forebears than many Ashkenazi Jews are.
Gotcha. but yeah, you know, just you know, I think we've probably exhausted, if I'm not cutting anybody off, you know, all of the rage fuel on this gentleman and the what you doing mountain rabbi.
Mountain goblets. Yes, exactly. They're mountain goblets. If you guys ever seen the those horrible Hobbit movies, that's exactly what the dwarves encountered in the mountain.
But yeah, you know, I didn't want to shortchange you, DK. You know, if we've exhausted the, you know, this guy's bizarre.
Oh no. Yeah. I mean, quick shout out or whatever, press F in the chat for the no coiners. Like myself who, missed the Bitcoin rally. That was the only other kind of,
I was desperately looking through some of my old wallets to see if I left any, you know, any coins behind in the couch cushions. But
yeah.
Once a no coiner, always a no coiner.
I actually did pretty well in the rally in 2017 with some shit coins. But I kept all the shit coins and they have not experienced any growth. So I'm like, fuck. But whatever, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, well, we'll know if somebody finds like a, you know, Boris Oley or DK, if one of you guys finds a hard drive, you know, with 100 Bitcoin from 2014 mm-hmm. or something on it, we'll know you've gotten it big, right? When we're doing show prep and you just respond with like, you know, fuck off, peasant. I don't have time for this.
I keep seeing the only other, I think it ties back into our previous discussion about like, you know, what to expect and what's going on. I don't know. I keep seeing, you know, everybody's always bullish on Bitcoin typically. And it has its ups and downs. The recent highs are, I'm sure, exhilarating for people who are on the train. I don't know. I maintain my skepticism that it will ever, it's not a medium of exchange. It probably never will be. I don't see how it could be. A store of value, maybe. But then there's this issue of, you know, what kind of value and under what conditions. And I don't know. It's I think we're still figuring out, you know, what exactly Bitcoin is other than a kind of speculative bubble type way for some people to make and a lot of people to lose significant amounts of money. But it's definitely something to watch moving forward.
Oh, definitely. But the
you guys have anything else?
There was something that just came across like my desk, well, metaphorical desk, while we were talking. I guess while we're on a vaguely economic note, you know, there's been some talk, right, about like what Trump's doing on his way out the door. You know, some of the, shall we say, questionable tribal pardons that he's made, and similarly, did just get something, and I'll drop this link in the chat, Frank. But just in terms of like general geopolitics, it looks like there's been three Chinese telecom companies that have been delisted per an executive order from the New York Stock Exchange. Anyway, it makes me wonder what's the next like neoliberal vector of attack, you know, in terms of like, are they going to cozy up to China? Is Biden, you know, as much as I hate to say it, Biden's probably going to be the president, you know, here in a couple of weeks and get sworn in. You know, is he going to try to freeze China out?
No, he's completely owned by China. I mean, that was the Hunter stuff that they didn't. I mean, I don't want to do too much normie politics, but no, they're functionally Chinese assets. So there's no chance of that, of any of that. And it's true that there's, I think the hawkish, the defense industry in the United States has a kind of problem where the people's appetite for war has long been exhausted, especially in the kind of low risk, you know, like nobody wants to be in Iraq or Afghanistan anymore. Zero people, other than I guess a handful, you know, the people that matter that make the decisions. But the American people are done with it and have been for years. And so if it's a place, you know, to actually use all those expensive weapons and technologies, you're kind of down to what, Iran and China and North Korea, sort of. I mean, where else is even plausible? And you can't win any of those fights. There's just no, like, I don't even think any of those fights are going to happen. You know, a guy I know who I respect said that the shot on Iran is day one no fly zone, and they try to starve him out economically and do a no fly zone type thing that can easily devolve into a hair trigger situation. Maybe, I mean, that seems plausible, but then you also run the problem of again, nobody thinks it's credible. The United States does not have the military capability to do any kind of actual force projection in a meaningful way against an adversary that can fight back in a meaningful way. And for the most part, the top people, the top brass knows that. So no, I mean, as far as what the shot is with China, I couldn't tell you other than expect a lot more Chinese infiltration of, the academic, you know, the university system, expect a lot more infiltration of the financial system, expect, just generally China to be an increasing, you know, real estate is big, obviously, especially on the West Coast. I know a lot, you know, to reiterate my stance again, I'll just say this again. It is true that, you know, you can't talk meaningfully about politics without addressing the Jewish question. You don't necessarily, you can talk politics without talking about Chinese, especially domestic politics. Foreign policy may be a slightly different story. Israel is an existential threat to Western civilization, to European people, to the European peoples and people of European descent. China is not. We can coexist with China. We cannot coexist with Israel. It would be a mistake, all of the above notwithstanding, to downplay the threat from China. China is a threat. They may not be the most important or an existential threat. They are a threat. They're something that needs to be taken very seriously, more seriously, I think, than people really are paying attention to. And unfortunately, the Biden administration enters the White House completely and thoroughly compromised by China. I won't even say like the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, that's silly, retard, you know, contard type shit. But like China as a geopolitical entity owns the Bidens, and that's a problem.
No, that totally makes sense. And I was not taking that into account. You know, this is sort of spur of the moment. You know, I'm sort of, you know, we're reacting to it, you know, just as we're discovering it. So I don't have any well thought out premonitions. I don't have any well thought out takes on this front, but I do wonder if maybe, you know, my thoughts are twofold. Like maybe Trump is giving the middle finger, you know, to China, perhaps, just trying to throw a wrench in things on his way out the door, maybe. The other thing that might be going on is, you know, it could be something that's perhaps, you know, happening with the blessing of the Chinese government, you know, sort of behind the scenes. One of the big sort of like open secrets in corporate America is that, you know, Apple, the iPhone company, they get a lot of low key, very favorable economic treatment because they buy up treasuries. You know, they supply, you know, they eat up a lot of the money printer going burr for debt issuance, more than a lot of major countries. You know, I just looked it up, and even going back to 2014, you know, it was notable about how much Apple was purchasing all of these treasury instruments, and, you know, maybe they don't make a great return on it, but it does curry them, you know, a lot of favor with the treasury, a lot of favor with, you know, the Chamber of Commerce type, you know, politicians and everything. So I don't know. I do wonder if this is a sign, right, that, you know, maybe Apple is during the holiday season, maybe trying to crush Chinese competition, trying to sink their hooks deeper into like the Chinese manufacturing base. We all know that Foxconn with its famous suicide nets.
I think you need to. Well, there's a kind of more woke take on this, maybe with apology. I don't mean to impugn your wokeness, but the reality of the smartphone industry, especially, but really any kind of computational industry, it's a sort of pick your poison situation where do you want to be spied on by Zog or do you want to be spied on by the Chinese? And Samsung, Apple, all the major, you know, US market device manufacturers, they all have NSA backdoors. They all have, you know, that's all like essentially hard coded and probably in the physical architecture itself. It's I've heard rumors about this with Intel chips. I don't know for sure that that's necessarily true. It's certainly something they want to do if they haven't already. And they probably have it to some extent of just basically what anything running on a system that is sold in mass market in the United States, just the government can flip a switch arbitrarily and get all your traffic. And Louis Conde said that's confirmed about Intel. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. The Chinese like also have their own, you know, the Huawei in particular makes really nice cell phones, which are banned essentially from sale in the United States because they do not participate in that program. Instead, it's the Chinese government that has the keys to your phone if you're on a Huawei device, which like I've considered very seriously, and I think we all should, anyone, you know, listening to this, you know, it may be a kind of 101 OPSEC type measure because there's ways to acquire Huawei phones. And once you have a Huawei phone, I mean, yeah, you still have to watch out for software. They can still get your traffic other ways, but it's that much harder for them to get your traffic if you're on a Chinese device. And I know that, you know, China and Russia and probably other players as well. Now, especially now that Intel, you know, increasingly moving their chip fabrication to Israel, like, God, oh my, just whatever. Yeah, you know, once, if and when there's a desktop, chip manufacturer that's not part of Zog, like, you definitely want those chips and not the Zog chips. It's worth getting maybe slightly worse performance or not. I mean, Huawei phones are great. There's no, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're technically quite capable, and the, you'll get the same kind of quality you get out of just, you know, mid to top of the line Android. So that's, and I think that's really what that's about, is they don't want people on devices that don't have NSA backdoors.
Oh, no, that totally makes sense. And that's a lot more straightforward, I guess, than, you know, what I was proposing off the cuff with, you know, sort of abstruse inner Chinese conflict or something going on. But again, you know, this is just sort of me shooting off the cuff.
Sorry, yeah, CIA Operative 14 and Louis Conde both say if you use Android on Chinese phones, it's sent to both China and U.S. Yes, Android is Google, which is CIA. So if you want to be secure, you would be using some other kind of, you know, operating system, not Android.
Well, jitterbug nationalism, perhaps. Bottom text.
I mean, there's other. I know there's other. I haven't. It's been years since I've looked into rooting phones and installing custom operating systems. And of course, you have to trust. But a lot of that stuff's open. So, I mean, I know there are other things you can use. And then the downside being that you're then locked out for the most part out of the app stores. But, you know, again, at a certain point, it becomes then a question of like, okay, why do you have a smart, you know, is it really like, you know, smartphones are in and of themselves kind of inherently insecure. Like do you want to be secure, get a Nokia brick or something like that.
Oh yeah, definitely. but anyway, yeah, that was,
you guys want me to quickly talk about vaccines?
Yes. Oh, and then, yes.
I'm not going to get into debates on COVID or vaccines. I'm just putting, I was going to read from this article, from David Wallace Wells. Yes, he's Jewish. From the Intelligencer, America's vaccine rollout is already a disaster. Really isn't much to get into with it. I guess we'll just read these two paragraphs quickly. How badly are we doing? In September, President Trump promised 100 million vaccinations by the end of the year. As a country, we have only 40 million doses and had aimed, according to Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar, to vaccinate 20 million by year. That's bad enough, but we have administered only 2 million of those, barely 10% of the goal. At this rate, achieving a sufficient vaccination to reach herd immunity and bring the pandemic to a close in the U.S. will take about 7 years. In Israel, they are vaccinating about 1% of the population each day, meaning the full program of population-wide vaccination will be done by this March. Of course, at that speed, the effects will show up much sooner as well because of the dramatic age skew of disease. Vaccinating the small number of very old people has an astonishing impact on mortality risk. According to one assessment of the Israeli approach, which focuses on protecting the elderly first, vaccinating just the 0.5% of people over 90 drops the total fatality risk by 19%. Vaccinating the 2.5% over 80 cuts it fully in half. Vaccinating the 7.5% over 70 drops it by 3/4. Ultimately, Israel chose to bulk vaccinate all those over 60, so the improvements are less dramatic than they might have been. But by late January, the country will probably have reduced its fatality risk from the disease about tenfold. The U.S. is not Israel. It is a large country, much more rural, with a much more complicated, indeed, tattered healthcare system. There are probably some understandable, if maddening, reasons that we are not moving as swiftly as others to administer the vaccine. But it is an awful show of hot potato responsibility that no entity or authority with the wherewithal to accelerate rollout is actually functioning properly. This is precisely as we were warned throughout the fall, as close observers noted that the federal government was dumping the responsibility onto states, most of which lacked capacity to truly administer the rollout, and many of whom would push the job to local groups, hospitals, and even pharmacies. Keep in mind that in 1947, New York City vaccinated 5 million people against smallpox in 2 weeks. Now, just look at this chart from Bloomberg's vaccine tracker, and I'm not going to bother with that, because I'm pivoting to another story. Employees at suburban Milwaukee clinic unknowingly gave out 57 shots with deliberately ruined vaccine, pharmacist arrested. And actually, what I found interesting was because I was curious who would do such a thing? What can I glean from the pharmacist who did this? And I had to find a couple stories. They even named the guy. So a hospital pharmacist who deliberately destroyed 500 doses of COVID vaccine. This is believed to be, and I actually didn't give this link to Frank, which has his picture, so I'll just pop that in the chat right now. The guy looks a lot like Walter White in his Heisenberg mode, but this is believed to be the hospital pharmacist accused of deliberately destroying 500 doses of Moderna's new COVID vaccine. Steven Brandenburg, 46, was booked into Ozaukee County Jail in Grafton, Wisconsin on Thursday on charges of recklessly endangering safety, adulterating a prescription drug, and criminal damage to property. There's no reasons that are given for why he did this. Now, I found a heavy.com article that mentioned him as well. Here we go. So he's apparently 46-year-old. They call him a white male. Brandenburg is a name that sounds German enough to me, and it's Wisconsin. But and the only details about his personal life, really, and he also lives in a small town in Wisconsin called Saukville. I don't know what the demographics of that are, but he's got a pharmacist license, and he's apparently going through some kind of divorce. He's in the middle of what sounds like a messy divorce that involves, you know, young children as well. I could speculate on what his motives were. They do know he deliberately left these out of the freezer to ruin the vaccines. Now, why would somebody, especially somebody like Steve Brandenburg, do such a thing? I guess if we were to make an assumption on it, to me, it sounds almost like Q-tier stuff, possibly, as a way to show like the vaccine actually isn't effective. It doesn't matter. Disease isn't real. That's just speculation on my part. I looked for a Facebook, see if I could find anything out about his political views or anything like that. Could just be a way of lashing out against the divorce. But I contrast these two stories to show, you know, David Wallace Wells is complaining about the fact that this has been basically parceled out to the smallest possible entities, including pharmacists, to deal with the vaccination. And when that is done, when this level of decentralization is done, people with their own personal or political motives can ruin the process. I don't say this is in either a pro or anti way. I'm being very neutral on this topic, but I'm illustrating like what this is what your country looks like, where it's a completely schizophrenic reality we're living in now, where you don't even know if the vaccine you're getting is even any good, whether or not you believe the vaccine works or not, or whether or not you believe the vaccine has any other ulterior effects, whatever you believe about the vaccines. This is the absolute state of the alternate reality we're living in, where you don't even know what exactly you're getting. As 57 people got these ruined vaccines. Take from that what you will.
Collapse. Ted Kaczynski. Baudrillard.
Collapse. Kaczynski. Graph. Graph.
Yeah, the graph one is always gets a chuckle out of me.
But it's a very Tainter-esque kind of moment, right? Of just a, you know, complex society completely unable to function. Because of, yeah. You know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah, it just set this up as a compare and, you know, contrast. Because 1947, they were able to easily vaccinate the population. They had no issues with this up and through, I think, like the 1970s. I forget when the smallpox vaccine was issued. They can't do it anymore. They, on a level of complexity, they are incapable of doing it. Again, however you feel about that, that's not the point. Like, I'm not talking about the actual details of the COVID stuff and the vaccinations. I'm talking about capability. I'm talking about ability.
So looking forward, expect more of that, which you made a kind of offhand reference to this, and we can maybe close out with making this point again, which is, yeah, like the people you can rely on. I mean, I think maybe hopefully people are long past the idea of this, but in case anyone isn't, you cannot rely on the government. You cannot rely on your, you know, your municipality, your county, your sheriff. You can't rely on anyone except your family and, you know, the people in hopefully your pool party or something like that you know you can call up at 3 a.m. no questions asked. That's your micro tribe. Those are the people you can rely on. Those are the people, and you need to be reliable for them. Right. This is a two-way street. You need to and to whatever extent you may not be, you need to work on I need to work myself on being reliable in that way, because tough times are coming. They're already here, and they're going to get tougher. And we, the way we get through this, and I have no doubt that we're going to get through this, and we're going to survive and thrive and come out of this stronger than we ever have been in maybe a very long time. I don't know if I'd say ever before, but certainly we're going to come out, and we're going to come out strong. But the way that we do that is we build our local communities, we build our local networks, we learn to rely on each other, and we resist the temptation to be atomized in the way that this culture, this sick joke of a society, keeps trying to make us atomized. That's how we win.
Hey, amen to that, man.
Nothing more to add.
All right. But yeah, I think we're all pushing up against some time limits here. So if I'm not cutting anybody short here, why don't we shill our plugs really quick and hit the old dusty trail? So
yeah,
Boris,
go listen to the latest Myth of the 20th Century. It's a 4-hour year in review. Titus and I are both on it.
And as I was remarking in show prep, I don't think we were recording at that time, but it does have some super spicy takes on there. My favorite of which was that the speculation that George Floyd wasn't even a real person.
That's just digital. That's digital.
Digital in fatigue. But DK, what you got for us, man? What do you got to share?
We got new NIGR episodes ready to drop just when I stop being a lazy ass. And that's it for now.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. And I believe the YouTube link will be in the show notes. I don't have anything to shill. Just y'all go to church. And, Frank, if we can cue up the music, we'll get on out of here. Thank you so much to the live audience. And I saw a few donations. Much appreciated. Apologies that I wasn't able to give everybody a shout out, but you know who you are, and we appreciate it greatly. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.